You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. I have been a vocal and harsh critic of the so-called Fix Our Forests Act, or FOFA, that is making its way through Congress. I'm not going to mince words. I think it's a cynical, bad faith bill that, at best, doesn't address the wildfire issues it purports to solve, and I think could actually make those issues much worse. Combined with the attempt by the administration to repeal the roadless rule, which protects vast swaths of public lands from road construction and extraction, and the Trump administration's executive orders dramatically increasing timber production targets on public lands, I really fear we are in danger of the kind of rampant ecosystem degradation or even destruction that we haven't seen since the darkest days of the timber wars. And I'm not alone. The vast majority of environmental and conservation organizations that I'm aware of are fiercely opposed to FOFA. So I was really surprised to see some organizations that I definitely respect lobbying hard in support of the bills. One of those organizations is Citizens Climate Lobby, a nonpartisan grassroots climate advocacy group that I really respect and have worked with before. I think that disagreeing respectfully and really listening to conflicting perspectives is a key part of civic engagement in a pluralistic society, so I invited them to come on the show and talk through the bill and some of our differences. Before we get started, I would love to hear from you. Yes, you! Send me an email sometime at coastrangeradio@gmail.com. You can follow Coast Range Radio on Instagram, send me a message there, and of course you can subscribe, free and ad-free, to our podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the places. Okay, Dana Nucitelli, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Yeah, hey Michael, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being game to have this conversation with me. Before we get into it, tell folks, what is Citizens Climate Lobby?
Yeah, we're a national nonprofit grassroots climate organization. We've got chapters in almost every congressional district around the country with volunteers in those chapters. And the main thing we do is we train them to lobby their members of Congress to support climate legislation that we think will do good things. They do other things too, like tabling and writing letters to the editor and opinion editorials and presentations and just general things to try to build the political will for climate policies and climate action. But the main thing we do, like the key thing, is our lobbying, of direct lobbying of our representatives.
Well, I want to start with a summary of the Fix Our Forest Act. And then I wanted to go over just kind of the bullet point talking points for Citizen Climate Lobby. And then I might stand in for a conservation opposition. And then after that, we can dig through some of those in a little more depth.
Okay.
If you could start out and just, to the best of your ability, without putting too much spin on the ball, what is the Fix Our Forest Act?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of different provisions in the bill. The general purpose of it is to reduce the risks of these megafires that we're increasingly seeing because of our combination of worsening climate change, hotter and drier weather, and denser forests that have resulted from over a century of very aggressive wildfire management, where we basically put out wildfires as quickly as possible and not allowed natural wildfires to burn. And that has resulted in our forests becoming much denser with vegetation than they were in the past. And so that combination of hotter, drier, and denser has basically created the conditions for these megafires that we're seeing much, much more frequently today than we were in the past. And so the idea is we're trying to reduce those wildfire risks. And so one of the things that the bill does, kind of the most potentially important slash controversial provisions, is it increases the categorical exclusion, which we can talk in details about that if you want, for doing these wildfire fuel reduction projects. Currently it's 3,000 acres. It expands that to 10,000 acres. So basically to allow the Forest Service to more efficiently do these wildfire fuel reduction projects, basically doing one per 10,000 acres instead of doing like three 3,000 acre categorical exclusions, which maybe we should define what those are.
Yeah. Could you just tell folks what a categorical exclusion is? And then we'll probably call them CEs a lot of the time as well. So we'll try to define the acronyms and then we can start using them.
Yeah. So this is part of the NEPA process, the National Environmental Policy Act, which is when a federal agency does something on federal land or related to federal actions. They have to go through this NEPA process to make sure they're minimizing the environmental impact of that, whatever that action is. And so these Forest Service wildfire fuel reduction projects are done under the NEPA process. And the NEPA process has kind of three categories of levels of kind of detail that they have to go through, a categorical exclusion being the least level of detail and rigor. And then there's environmental assessments kind of in the middle, and environmental impact statements are the most rigorous.
Yeah, and you're right that that is one of the most impactful and controversial aspects of the bill, and we'll get into that. You also, I mean, the public talking points you have are around like protecting America's forests, protecting communities, and then protecting livelihoods, which I will say, none of those immediately speak to climate. So I'm curious, like beyond the public lobbying points, what your climate pitch for this is.
Yeah, so we don't just deal with climate mitigation, so reducing emissions. There's also climate adaptation resilience is another concern of ours that we try to address with our policies that we support. And that's kind of the main category where FOFA falls, is the sort of resilience aspect of climate change, reducing the risk that people's homes and lives are going to be put at risk by these extreme megafires.
Well, and I will say, extreme megafires is definitely not a technical term. And so that term in and of itself, I would say, is somewhat controversial. And actually, just to give an overview of what you'll hear from most conservation and public land advocacy groups is the categorical exclusions, which they say 10,000 acres is about 15 square miles. So allowing these categorical exclusions to be more than tripled, which means very little or no oversight or ability to challenge those, making it easier to avoid, you know, what we consider bedrock environmental laws like that NEPA or National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act. And I'm not a lawyer, but what I read is that the bill will allow land managers to use emergency authorities to do things like NEPA and ESA consultations after a project has happened in some cases, which seems kind of wild. And then, you know, what a lot of people would push back on is just kind of the narrative of logging and active management in the backcountry as effective in protecting communities from wildfire. And I definitely want to dig deep into that because that's a pretty meaty piece. But so how would you initially respond to those concerns?
So can you like specify which concern you'd like me to address? Because that was kind of a lot.
I was just kind of going over like the main points you'll see, you know, a group like Sierra Club or whatever make. Let's see. Well, I guess let's just start digging in deep, right? So from your perspective, these categorical exclusions are important and necessary. Obviously, from the conservation point of view, it's a way of cutting the public out of the process.
I mean, I wouldn't say it cuts the public out because, like, again, categorical exclusions are part of the NEPA process. It's just the least stringent environmental review part. But like the agency still have to consider the environmental impacts. There is still opportunity for public input and lawsuits if necessary. So I wouldn't say cutting out. I would say it just creates less paperwork for the Forest Service staffers to engage in.
Yeah, and I mean, there's certainly, I would say, a live and vigorous debate around whether environmental regulations have become too strict and onerous for agencies. And I don't want us to go too deep into that, but just to acknowledge that that does exist. And I think people of varying stripes of good faith can have a good faith disagreement on that. But that certainly is, you know, a major concern of, I think, a lot of folks. And then, you know, obviously these environmental laws like NEPA and the ESA, et cetera, are, I mean, one of the key components historically that have saved intact native old growth forests, right? So regardless of the way you think they'll be used in the current context, I think it's important to recognize the historical context of why those things are important. Because without them, if from the very beginning, the land managers had been able to circumvent those laws, we just would basically have no old growth left, right? And so I guess the question that I'm getting around to is how is this context different? Like, how can we trust, especially during the current Trump administration, you know, this bill is brought forward by a Republican congressman who is a quote-unquote forester, which means that he's trained in silviculture. I have known about Westerman for a long time because he's always advancing these bills to basically increase timber production. So given the current context, why shouldn't people be so concerned about using emergency authorities to override these environmental laws? Sorry for that very long wind up. I apologize.
That's okay. Yeah, no, that's okay. And Westerman was like one of the sponsors of the House version. There is now a Senate version that's got two Republican and two Democratic co-sponsors. One of them's Alex Padilla, one of my senators from California. And they made significant changes, or more additions to the bill in the Senate version, which I think there are a lot of positive changes there. But in general, I think there was a lot of valid concern about overlogging in public forests, like in the 1990s, for example. I think now there's about one quarter of the public logging on public lands as there was in the 1990s as a result of like a lot of these restrictions becoming more stringent. So like the question now is like, have we gone too far there? Is it now too difficult to do these kinds of projects? And so that's a valid debate. I agree. Like it's not an easy answer there, but at this point, at least we have addressed a lot of that overlogging on federal lands. Now, like the vast majority of timber that's logged in the United States is done on private lands. And so like, there's also not a lot of infrastructure for, you know, processing any of like, if we were to increase the amount of timber logged on public lands, like there's not a lot of like sawmills and lumber mills and infrastructure to process that. So that's kind of another constraint that would hold back like a vast increase of the logging on public lands, even if that were a big concern as a result of FOFA. So that's another, I think, thing to consider when worrying about like, are we going to have to worry about timber production going way up on public lands? That would be a difficult thing to do.
So since I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an expert, I have read the bills. I cannot make heads or tails of legislative language. So I'm going to kind of skip over a lot of the technical stuff. And I want to go right to the core premise of the bill. The premise of the bill and so much of what is happening around trying to increase, to say it in the most neutral way possible, active management of forests on public lands is the idea that there is a wildfire crisis that needs to be addressed. Now, I think the idea that there is a wildfire crisis is actually not per se factual. That's an opinion. Another way of looking at it is that we have a home conflagration crisis, which is we have an issue of homes interacting with fires and burning down. The research that I've seen, including from the Forest Service, suggests that actually we're at a fire deficit, which you talked about as well. The century of fire suppression has led us to a fire deficit. So what people will say is, actually, we need more fire on the land, which goes to your point about more prescribed burns, et cetera, et cetera. So saying we're in a wildfire crisis, already problematic in my humble opinion. But even then, I think the issue that it is purporting to solve there, in my opinion, it doesn't solve that. And I just want to explain my personal rationale there and then have you respond to that. Yeah. Because if the goal is to protect communities and homes from burning down, I think the research that I understand is pretty clear that home hardening is money way better spent than thinning in the backcountry. And, you know, much more effective, much more cost effective, et cetera, et cetera, and proven. If the goal is healthy forests, then I think there's a live debate around what kind of management should exist on which ecotypes, et cetera, right? But that is a really difficult discussion. And with all due respect, I don't think Bruce Westerman thinks about forest health in the same way that I think about forest health. So like, what do you think the wildfire issue is that needs to be addressed? Is it the healthy forests or is it the communities? And how is this bill meeting those goals? Because I don't think those would be the same prescriptions.
Yeah. Okay.
Lot there.
A lot to unpack there. So yeah, I think on the issue of the wildfire concern, it is twofold. It is impact on homes and people's health and well-being and possessions. So there is the community hardening aspect, and there actually is a section in Fix Our Forests Act on community hardening and home hardening, which I think is a really important section of the bill to have.
So actually, on that point, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. That's right. So what percentage of the money is devoted to, and I'm not saying defensible space, I'm saying home hardening.
So one, I guess, part of the bill that's criticized, which I think is valid, is that it doesn't have prescribed dollar amounts. It doesn't like say this much money needs to be spent on this, and it doesn't in fact have any specific funding in it. And so some people have said, like, well, like, we shouldn't pass the bill unless it is actually funded, which is a valid critique, although it's actually not uncommon for bills to be passed without having funding. Like, it's that they're then subsequently funded in the appropriations process, which is happening right now. It's that kind of the government fight over staying open and whatnot is how much money to appropriate to different government agencies. And so, like, one way we've addressed that particular critique is to lobby Congress to adequately appropriate funds for the Forest Service to implement the Fix Our Forest Act. But there is a valid critique that right now, like, there is not funding currently associated with the bill. It just says, do this stuff to do community hardening and this other stuff to create a wildfire intelligence center, which to another point that in response to what you were just saying is that, like, the bill does, it creates like a wildfire intelligence center. It creates like regional wildfire research centers so that, like, there's basically groups of federal agencies and academic experts and state experts and tribal experts who kind of get together and in the wildfire research centers and the regional centers, they like look at their region specific wildfire risks and how to best address those. And so they're trying to incorporate the best science into how to reduce the wildfire risks in our particular region. And then like the wildfire intelligence center does kind of a similar thing nationwide. And actually my Senator Adam Schiff added an amendment to the bill that has the National Academies of Science do a study basically to look at the efficacy and cost effectiveness of the kinds of wildfire fuel reduction projects that are implemented in the bill. So we've got a lot of science kind of trying to look into how to most effectively reduce these wildfire risks, which is one part of the bill. As a scientist myself, I really appreciate that they're trying to get like the best scientific researchers and different with different perspectives and different agencies and you know, federal and local levels getting together and looking at like how do we reduce these wildfire risks based on the science.
But again, what is the this is what I'm trying to get at, is the core issue is like, what is the issue we're trying to solve for? Because again, protecting houses from burning is a different issue than having a healthy forest in the backcountry or even half a mile away from those homes. So, and every ecotype is different. So what is the actual issue that we are trying to address here?
Then there's a second issue, which is, well, there's a couple of issues associated with, but it is the amount of forest being burned, which creates one big problem is wildfire smoke that we're all breathing. And myself being, you know, in California, like I still have trauma from like the 2020, 2021 fires where like I couldn't go outside the entire summer because the air was just full of hazardous smoke and their air quality was terrible. And like that kind of scarred me and made me feel like we have to do something to reduce those smoke risks from large fires.
I hear that. And I mean, I think 2020 broke a lot of us for a variety of reasons. And and so there are these places where the fire smoke just kind of collects, right? And that is rough. Like, absolutely, whether it's affecting your health adversely or not, it's like, it sucks. Here's what is hard for me to square, because then we all acknowledge that actually we should have more fire on the landscape. And so it's like, okay, how, like, what level of smoke are we going to have to just accept? And I understand that some of it is burning at different times of the year, low severity fire results in less smoke, et cetera, et cetera. So I know there's a lot of nuance there, but I guess maybe my point there is like, we are going to have smoke and we are going to have high severity fires, like high severity fire or even stand replacement fire, you know, using the technical terms, like that is a fact of nature. And we're just never going to get fully away from that.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, the idea is if you can do prescribed burns and or mechanical thinning, like even if you're doing prescribed burns, you're at least doing it in a controlled condition where in most cases you can limit the amount of area that's being burned and thus the amount of smoke that's going up into the air. So you're not having like, you know, thousands of acres of forest burning at the same time. It's just a limited area.
Yeah, yeah.
So that the smoke is kind of, it's less of a health impact to a smaller area.
Well, I think the critics of this bill and a lot of the, you know, management stuff that's being proposed are, I mean, you'll find very few people in the conservation world who are not down with prescribed burns. We just went through this with the Northwest Forest Plan Amendment process, which you know, might not be familiar with because it's up here, right? Huge thing. I won't go into it all, but, you know, there was a huge push in the conservation world to really lift up like tribal burning, to support prescribed burns, and even like non-commercial thinning and mastication is, I wouldn't say universally accepted, but most groups accept that some of that is relevant. I think what it comes down to is trust. Mm-hmm. I think that people like myself don't trust the current context of the Forest Service and their incentive structure of the Trump administration, et cetera, to be implementing this in a good faith way. Mm-hmm. Why do you think this is not, as I described it earlier, like a cynical play to just increase timber production? Why can we trust the Trump administration and Representative Bruce Westerman to be like actually helping forest health?
Sure.
As their primary objective.
And I mean, I totally understand being skeptical of the Trump administration's motives on you know, anything related to anything, period, really. But I mean, what I would say is that these like fuels management projects are written and implemented by career Forest Service staffers who are like, they're in the forest, like they joined the Forest Service for the purpose of like, they care about forests and they want to protect forests. And actually in the Senate, I believe, had a hearing on the Fix Our Forests Act back in May, and they invited an acting associate, like one of the heads of the Forest Service, who's like, he's, you know, in the Forest Service in the Trump administration. And his testimony, actually, it made me feel a lot better, because like he was really talking about like, yeah, we just really want to protect the health of the forest, like, and then like you could say,
and that's what they all
you
say.
Can do that cynically, but like if you watch it, like my perspective, what I was like, he was being like sincere and honest in his desire to actually, like, his job is to protect the health of American forests. And you know, you can say, okay, well, you know, maybe he's not being honest, but at least like that was my perspective, was that he seemed sincere about that. And more importantly, like the people who are writing these actual projects and plans are like their career Forest Service staffers. Like my more concern for me is that they don't have the resources to do this as much now, because there's been so much, you know, so many layoffs and like the DOGE retirements and things like that. So there's just fewer of them there anymore, and like they have fewer resources, which is one reason that we are lobbying for appropriations to at least adequately fund the Forest Service. But like they've still lost a lot of staffers over the past year. So like that's just concerning, that they just don't have the resources that they used to implement these kinds of projects. But like that is true with or without the Fix Our Forests Act. Like they're just low staffed, as every agency is, which is unfortunate. But that's separate.
That's such a good point, though. I mean, very few people would advocate for the Forest Service not to exist. I think there's a lot of folks, myself included, that think that the timber sales divisions have way too much power within the Forest Service. And there's just a bias towards active management within the agency. I think that I agree, there's a lot of career staffers who care a lot, right? And but, you know, there is that bias to action, and that bias to action led them far, far astray not that long ago historically, and kind of is the reason that we're in this mess in the first place. So to me, it's like the same ideology and way of thinking that got us into the mess is like, and now we'll just do more active management to get us out of the mess. But that's just my bias. I take your point. And, you know, it is really hard to understand what is going on in a person's head. Like, are they sincere? Are they not? You know, you can't. There's some people you can probably tell, but most people you don't.
Fair enough. I want
to push you one more time on the home hardening piece. Because this is always something that people are like, yeah, it's important. But then it always gets short shrift. And if you look at like fire funding as a pyramid, right? Or you know, like wildfire mitigation funding or whatever, there's basically a blank check for suppression. Once the wildfire starts happening, and is like deemed to be out of control, then we wage war on it, right? And cut a blank check, deal with it later, right?
Sure.
Then you have the second most, you know, biggest pot of money is mechanical thinning, backcountry, this and that and the other thing. Then you have some money left over for these like defensible space projects. And then there's almost never any money, very, very little for the home hardening. But in reality, it should be exactly the inverse, because home hardening is the like demonstrated way of keeping homes from burning down. I mean, just look at any series of pictures from some of these large fires that interacted with communities, and you'll see houses standing perfectly fine amid other torched houses. You'll see houses torched with standing live trees next to them, right? So I guess, like, where does that fall on your calculus? The protecting communities, right? Mm-hmm. And if it's high, then how do you justify supporting a bill that really doesn't address it in a substantive way currently?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think it's high. Like, that is sort of the most direct impact on people, is the threat that wildfires pose to their homes and their. But like I said, there is a section on community and home hardening in the bill. Like, I don't remember all the details off the top of my head what's in that section, but there is a section on it. Like, you could certainly argue it should be a part, like a larger section, or like a bigger focus of the bill. And that's kind of a subjective question, because the bill is doing a lot of different things in one piece of legislation. Like, you could certainly support like a separate piece of legislation that focuses exclusively on community and home hardening, for example. So that's kind of a subjective thing. Like, and again, there's not like dollar numbers associated with specific provisions of the bill. It's just like, we're going to support these things, and then like later on the process we'll get the appropriations, and then that stuff will get funded, and you know, we'll see where the money goes. But at least there is stuff in the bill about community and home hardening. So I think that's at least a positive development, is that there is, you know, there are measures in there to address that.
Yeah, I guess I mean, we're obviously not going to resolve that, but that's a point that I definitely disagree with you on, is that it's pretty clear to me how this would shake out, and maybe I'll be wrong, because there's a clear pipeline for active management in the forest. And if the premise of the bill is that we have to do all this wildfire risk reduction in public lands, and home hardening is important too, then that, again, like I say, is inverting the pyramid of what our priorities should be. So in my view, the bill should be a home hardening bill that says, and if we have money left over, we will do this forest restoration stuff, because what we care about is protecting homes and communities from burning down more than we care about whether there are fires in the backcountry.
I mean, I'd say that's a valid critique. And again, it's kind of subjective, because I am also worried about like the size of megafires and the amount of smoke that they're creating and the amount of carbon that's being lost in the atmosphere when they burn. And I'm also concerned about people directly being impacted by fires encroaching on their homes. And so, you know, it's subjective. Like, should we be waiting more of one than the other? And, you know, this is just kind of where they landed in Congress.
Well, great. I could respond to a couple of those things, but I think that is a great place to leave it. I think it's fair enough to give you the last word. So,
thanks.
Dana, thank you so much for joining me on Coast Range Radio. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. It was nice talking to you, and I appreciate you looking for perspective from the other side. Like, I do the same thing, and so it's nice to have that kind of dialogue and interaction. So I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Hope to be able to have you back, and we can assess in 5 years' time.
Yeah, sounds good. Let's see what the National Academy of Science says about whether these things are working or not.
All right. And that's all we have time for today on Coast Range Radio. We're an independent, volunteer-run show. You can find Coast Range Radio free and ad-free on all podcast apps. You can follow us on the Instagram if you're into that sort of thing. If you want to drop us a line, let me know what you think of the show. The email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Say hi sometime. Thank you so much for listening. Let's make it through this together.
listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's zine, The Boo Beat, is back with a second issue, featuring KBOO's program guide, interviews with local activists and community members, spotlights on local businesses,